proceed to the third case of the day, Fields versus Wilbur Law Firm. Stradlin.
Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. This is a Fair Debt Collection Practices Act case. The defendant sent a series of four dunning letters to the plaintiff to collect a veterinary bill. The initial letter claimed an accounts balance of $388, stated that it was long past due, and that it represented an unpaid bill to our client. In fact, the amount that the plaintiff had agreed to pay the vet was $138. The other $250 was attorney's fees, which the defendants had just added to the debt. The attorney's fees...
This sounds like deja vu all over again from last week, right?
Somewhat similar, but we do not raise the question of whether authorization by a court was required in this appeal. We simply allege two things. One, that lumping the attorney's fees together with the debt...
That was one of the issues in last week.
That was, yes. And then, in this case, they went further. They call the attorney's fees an account balance. They call it an unpaid bill to our client and state that they were long past due. None of those three statements is true. In fact, they just added the $250. We also claim that $250 for having a late collector send out one collection letter by use of a computer is not reasonable. The district court dismissed the complaint, initially stating that letters 2 through 4 did break out what the debt consisted of and clarified any confusion. We filed a motion for reconsideration pointing out that the second through fourth letters were basically the same as the first letter, containing similar incorrect statements, and also that under this court's precedence, a false statement in one letter is not cured by other statements, even if they were truthful, in subsequent letters. Among other things, if somebody is induced to pay the bill after the first letter, you don't get the second through fourth letters. In addition, in the Bartlett case, this court held that even if a plaintiff doesn't read a collection letter, if it violates the statute, you can still collect statutory damages under the unsophisticated consumer standard. After we filed the motion for reconsideration, the district court changed its reasoning but adhered to the result, stating that any confusion could be cured by calling up and asking for clarification. The problem with that is that it assumes that one has either received and retained or recalls the amount one agreed to pay. This plaintiff did not get a copy of the contract or bill or did not retain it and did not recall the amount. It also makes some other assumptions which are not appropriate, that the same person who incurred the expense is paying it, which is often not the case, and that the bill was presented in such a way that you can correlate it with the later Dunning letter. Certainly I've gotten medical bills, and then later one of them says, this is from the radiologist, it's separate from the prior bill, you have to pay this separately. None of these assumptions is appropriate on a motion to dismiss.
Did your client pay any of these bills? Did she pay the vet bill or part of it or for the service?
The record does not reflect, and I do not know the answer to that, Your Honor.
You don't?
I do not, Your Honor.
Well, there's a lot of things in your brief that I don't know how to characterize it, but really lower the standard of this person. That, you know, they don't know the bill, they don't know that they signed a bill, they don't know how much. I assume the cat or dog got service.
Yes, Your Honor.
So somebody, I don't know how unsophisticated it takes to someone that doesn't think they owe some money, or when they get a letter, this is obviously a problem with these cases. You have a relatively small amount of money that collecting is pretty darn difficult. You say the attorney's fees are too high. I'm sure class action lawyers have been accused of having attorney's fees that are too high as well. I don't know what it takes to collect a little debt like this, but what's reasonable?
Well, the Circuit Court of Cook County will allow $350, I believe it's by administrative order, for sending in whatever pre-suit demand is required, preparing a standard complaint, filing it, and obtaining a default judgment in a case in which no defense is interposed. I would not have a problem if reviewing the file and sending out the initial letter, assuming it to have been actually performed by an attorney, consumed a third of that, about $100. Two-thirds, about 70-72%, would be the assumption here, is I don't think accurate or reasonable. I question, incidentally, whether any attorney laid eyes or hands upon this particular account. We alleged and attached some of the defendant's promotional material indicating that, in fact, this is entirely handled by lay debt collectors, that transmission of the information occurs electronically, and that it appears that what happened was that a lay debt collector commanded a computer to to generate a form letter, and that's what happened.
Now, if this thing had been split in half, or not half, but divided, for instance, it said account balance, and then it said, let's say, whatever was it, how much was the bill itself,
$138.
So it said 138, what would you want to say?
Veterinary bill.
And then the next 250 attorney's fee. That would cure that part of the letter.
It would solve the problem with respect to the confusing nature of the letter, yes.
But you obviously, you still think the attorney's fees are too high, but that would at least cure the notice to the unsophisticated.
Yes, Your Honor. I do believe that breaking it out would have cured it, and certainly they should not have affirmatively misstated the character of the attorney's fee claim.
Okay. It being long overdue?
I'm sorry?
Being long overdue?
Well, it wasn't long overdue. It was not your unpaid bill to our client, and it's not an account balance. Plaintiff had agreed to pay the $138 previously. I think that's what account balance connotes.
So what you'd want up there at the top of the unpaid bill is that, and then attorney's fee, instead of calling it account balance.
Yes, or any other accurate description of what the claim is. I do not think that calling an unliquidated amount of attorney's fees, which has just been claimed, part of an account balance, an unpaid bill to our client, or long past due. I don't think any of those three statements are accurate, Your Honor. I see I'm into my rebuttal time, so unless Your Honors have some questions, I'll...
All right. Thank you, Sam. Ms. Olson?
May it please the Court, good morning, Your Honors. My name is Christine Olson. I'm here on behalf of the Wilbur Law Firm defendants. I will make my comments brief. The crux of the plaintiff's argument here is that this letter somehow violated the FDCPA because the attorney's fees and vet bill balance were lumped together. The letter mentioned one sum. There is no authority from this circuit which says that a letter must break down amounts claimed. In fact,
well, there probably was going to be because, as I mentioned, there was a case last week having the same issue.
The Singer case, Your Honor. Yeah. The Miller case. And since Miller, there have been subsequent decisions from this court, 2A, which state that the letter must state the amount due the day the letter was sent. And that's what this letter said. It set forth, this is what you owe on this day that we're sending out the letter. It didn't leave unspecified interest. It didn't leave unspecified amount of attorney's fees. It said to Ms. Fields, you owe this amount of money. And
different letters had it broken down different ways. Is that...
Different letters had different amounts because of, I believe, interest charges.
Interest charges, but it was always a lump sum?
Correct, correct. Each of the four letters had a lump sum. The plaintiff also makes the argument that these attorney's fees were somehow not part of Ms. Fields' account with the vet, but Ms. Fields did sign the contract with the veterinarian's office stating that if collection actions were necessary, and I'm paraphrasing, she would be responsible for attorney's fees. She signed that contract. So I believe her responsibility for the attorney's fees is part of her account, with the veterinarian which rendered the service.
And he indicates, I guess, that, I don't know whether he knows this or not, but apparently the copy of this contract, which is obviously very clear, was not sent out with the collection letter. Is that right?
I do not believe a copy of the contract was sent with the letter, Your Honor. That's not apparent of record. What is apparent was that the original complaint did not have a copy of that contract attached. We filed a motion to dismiss. Judge Mim stated he would not convert it to a motion for summary judgment. The plaintiff then filed an amended complaint with a copy of the contract attached.
Now, when is that handed to the individual? At the time of agreeing to the services?
Your Honor, I do not know.
The record doesn't indicate.
That
language that's relied upon, that I understand if collection should become necessary, I agree to pay collection costs and attorney's fees. That's the payment installment agreement.
That's correct.
Now, and the record doesn't reflect when Ms. Fields or any other consumer receives that?
Well, it has a date of March 16, 2002, and on the date she signed it. I do not know.
And I assume that at the point of the rendering of services, and so the record doesn't reflect when she receives that in hand or takes it with her? Or
it does not, Your Honor. The record does not. I would make the same assumption, but that's just my assumption. I don't know for a fact.
But that language is not repeated in the demand letter, though.
No, it is not.
Right.
No, it is not.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a great burden to separate it, would it?
No, I don't think so. But I don't think it's misleading or creates some sort of false impression on the consumer by having it all lumped together. I mean, that is the amount that the veterinary now claims is owed, that full amount, you know, the services and the attorney's fees. And if, as the district court noted, the first letter had the 6092G required information, the consumer can always call. You know, and that the first letter set forth the required language, and the consumer can make the phone call. I know this came up in the Singer case last Friday, this particular issue.
Well, it does jump off, though. If you brought a pet in for whatever the required services are, and you have a general idea of the number, let's say $150, services are rendered, and there is not payment within a requisite period of time, and then a number arrives,
mm-hmm.
That seems a multiple of.
Right.
It takes a pretty discerning consumer, does it not, to then recognize that he or she has made an earlier obligation that has been accumulated and maybe well due and owing.
I could see that if this were a case where Ms. Fields had not signed the contract acknowledging that she would be responsible for paying fees if she didn't pay the vet bill. And all of a sudden she got a letter and she looked at her vet bill. But here she signed that specific agreement and then she didn't pay the bill. So you would think that even with an unsophisticated consumer, you realize I didn't pay the bill. I signed an agreement which said I'd be responsible for collection costs and attorney's fees.
So well, that was my question about when that's handed, you know, how that language
right.
jumps out initially and whether it carries with it
right.
the emphasis that one would hope.
Well, this also is in a situation where she, obviously this is not on the record, where she was shown this statement saying you'll be responsible for attorney fees, and she didn't sign it. Here the agreement is signed. She signed.
Oh, no, I don't think there's any question about the signing.
So at least she had to see it at one point.
Well, we assume that when the sick debt comes in, you don't sign when it gets sick. So there she is, and it owes $122 that don't have the money. But after payday, I'll have it,
mm-hmm.
something like that. So this is what they apparently routinely do. We don't know. We don't know whether she paid any of it. We don't know a whole lot of things at this point, but that's sort of the assumption. The problem here is to what extent is this law technically violated by a relatively small debt and not going the letter of the law?
Well, I don't... Looking at the language of 6092E, which uses the word false amount or false character, I don't think you could say it's false to say to a consumer, you owe us this amount of money.
But it could be confusing.
Well, Your Honor, I think in this situation, again, when she's agreed to pay these bills, excuse me, the attorney's fees and the bill, I think even using the unsophisticated consumer standard, she would know she's on the hook for something more than the bill, and that would lead to that higher amount.
So her job would be to subtract what she recalls as the original bill from this to arrive at the attorney's fee?
She could do that if she still had a copy of the bill. If she didn't, under the 1692G language contained in the first letter, she could call and ask and challenge. And if she, and that's the procedure set in place, if the consumer or the debtor challenges the validity of the debt.
Is there any law, case law, or whatever that puts an unsophisticated consumer in a category of someone that wouldn't have an inclination to make the phone call when he got this?
Well, I know that was the problem with this court's decision in Miller, where the court said when the letter didn't specify the amount of interest and said you have to call the 800 number, and this court said, you know, that's very difficult. Sometimes you can't get through, and you'll never be able to find out the exact amount due and owing. So the Miller case does address that issue. But in that case, unlike this case, the whole problem was the letter didn't specify the exact amount due the date it was sent. That is the only one I'm aware of. Unless the court has anything further.
Well, thank you, Ms. Olson.
Thank you.
Mr. Abel.
Your Honors, I will be very brief. I think the obligation under 1692E is on the debt collector to do nothing which is false, deceptive, or misleading. It prohibits both affirmative representations and means which are deceptive.
Well, it's got to be misleading, right? It's not false or deceptive.
I think it's misleading, and I think it actually is false.
Well, how do we arrive at a false conclusion?
Okay. The word account implies a prior agreement to the
specific
amount.
Do you have two accounts when you go to the veterinarian? You have the account for the rent services and a pending potential account to come online if you don't pay on time? Is that what people should view?
No, Your Honor. I think that the word account is commonly used. Anyone who has a credit card knows what a statement of account is. And basically it implies a prior agreement to the actual dollar amount, either expressly or by having it and not objecting to it within a couple of billing.
But your credit card account carries the interest if you don't pay on time, right? I mean, or the monthly charge or whatever.
Oh, right, and that's expressly
that's built in, that concept of a number higher than the price of the washing machine, right?
Yes, but I've seen lots of collection complaints on credit card debts. And nobody, as far as I know, calls the attorney's fees, if authorized, part of the account. It's a claim for attorney's fees. I don't think that you have previously agreed to the specific amount of fees, which is what an account stated or a statement of account implies. It is not really a bill to the client, nor has it been long past.
Because the expression attorney's fees is so open-ended, is that the distinction? Because when you pay on a credit card, of course, may vary based on what your options are, but it's at least knowable theoretically because
yes,
of the interest.
It's computable.
Yeah. So is it? That's why I get back to whether it's false or deceptive or is it misleading because you haven't got.
I think
the language is important. So
I think all three of them are implicated, and I maintain that a statement of account means that either you have agreed to the specific amount expressly, or you have received the statement listing the amounts and have agreed to it by not objecting to it. She did not agree to $250.
If the original payment installment agreement carried with it, I agree to pay $250 in attorney's fees. The attorney's fees that, in fact, were added on here in that original agreement. And then we had the $388, whatever, arrived. What would we have then? Would we still have a problem?
I would not file a claim, a case alleging that it was misleading. Theoretically, there's the question of whether it's reasonable, but I doubt if I would have filed
So the weakness here, at a minimum in your view, is that the exact amount of potential liability due to an attorney's fees add-on wasn't specifically specified at the outset.
not only wasn't specified, but was then later mislabeled as something that you had agreed to, and as something long overdue and as part of the bill, none of which is true.
Mr. Edelman, if I may, if you know, and you may not, if this person, Ms. Fields, sent in $388.54 in response to the first letter, how would that money be transmitted to the animal hospital?
You mean what the breakdown was between the debt collector and the hospital? I do not know, Your Honor. I would assume
I didn't ask your opponent, but that's my point is that it may be withheld and then passed on. I don't know.
That's not shown in the record, and I do not know the answer, Your Honor.
Do you want to make that inquiry?
Okay. Thanks.
I see my time is up, so.
Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.